Go.
Tuned into the Awakening Zone Radio Network, your news and information source for empowered spiritual awakening.
Hello, this is Karen Elkins. Is this a science page? Oh, no. I'm having technical difficulties this morning, and I apologize for that. I have two great guests today, and I might let them take over just for a bit while I'm trying to deal with my technical stuff. I have Don Estes. And I have Joseph Tills and Mike Waters will come on in the next hour. And gentlemen, they both know each other really well. I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves while I take some of the technical difficulties here. Joseph, do you mind introducing yourself first? And then Don, and I sincerely apologize for that. This is where Science to Sage Radio comes alive. But for some reason, I do not have phone service this morning. I'm using my cell phone, and I'm getting echoes. So, Joseph, go ahead while I try to solve my dilemma.
Well, good morning. And good luck with the dilemma so that it can be quickly and easily, and we can progress from there.
Thank you. Well, keep going, because here's the, with you guys introducing each other, the show today is on the science of sound and water, and we have two really profound guests who can just dial into this topic with the greatest of ease. So let's see if I can get my other stuff dealt with while these guys introduce themselves. Thank you.
Well, my background started many years ago in industrial engineering. And through those processes, I was exposed to certain elements that technically challenged my life, let's say. And through those processes, I was exposed to how sound was able to help me deal with post-traumatic stress in a way that I found very interesting, because it opened up my mind to the potential possibility that the thing that we take for granted, which is sound, some very deep and profound aspects that, well, frankly, were hidden from the general public. And through my process of discovery, self-discovery, I discovered that not only is sound the key to a lot of the aspects of the fundamental forces of nature, but also it affects consciousness, it affects health, and it actually even affects matter at the quantum level. And so my long-term study with it has been more of an intimate sabbatical, I would say, because it's a daily ritual. It's something that keeps me going. And I think I'll leave it at there for now and let Don introduce himself.
Hey, everyone.
Hi, Don.
My name is... Hello, how are you?
I'm good, Don.
Good. So my company, InterSense, has been researching and developing sensory technology since about 1984. And over the years, we've developed a lot of sound technologies that are now well-known names, like vibrasound, which is a fluid transducer that turns your body into a speaker such that you feel the music coming in from every cell of your body. And one of our main areas of research and development has been in the science of psychoacoustics. And that is a science that studies how sound affects the human mind and body. And our particular version of that we now call psioacoustics, which includes spiritual aspects as well as the mind and body aspects. So for the past 10 years, we've had a real sophisticated supercomputer-controlled quantum biofeedback process based on human voice and breath. And Karen, you've talked a little bit about that in some of your magazines, and we've had some radio shows about that before. But that's basically our background, is in sensory science, transformational technologies, and psychoacoustics.
So hello, gentlemen?
Yes.
Yep, I'm here.
Great. Okay, I'm just trying to get, I don't know if you guys are hearing my background noise or not, or the fade. Can you hear that?
I can just hear an echo, is what it sounds like to me.
Yeah. That's what I was wondering. I'm hoping to get rid of that. But okay. So anyway, I'll do the best that I can.
Somebody has their
I think somebody must have hit a telephone pole around here. So I'm going to try to be as non-talkative as possible and let you guys talk. But let's start with the idea of this, Dawn. And you've had a lot of what I'm going to call, affectionately called, downloads lately about your concern about what's happening with sound and how it's affecting ourselves and the world. So why don't we start there? What have been the things that have been concerning you about sound?
Well, as I mentioned, for the past 10 years, we've been developing quantum biofeedback processes. And right in the midst of finalizing the audio portion of that process that we now call the cortical, we made a really major discovery that, I'm sorry, Karen, I can hardly hear anything. There's so much of an echo. Does someone have a speaker?
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go off and then I'm going to come back on. So you guys keep talking and you and Joseph carry on the conversation and I'll see if I can dial in another way.
Okay. All right. Okay, great. That works much better. Thank you. So right in the midst of finalizing the audio portion of the portal, we made a really major discovery that explains why recording never quite sounds as good as the original live presentation. And it turns out that music has the same dichotomy structure as a human being by consisting of components that originate from both the player and an instrument, just like music does, and just like a human being does at the most basic level of our reality. We are a machine, but we're also the operator of the machine. We have this instrument that we live inside of, but we're the player of the instrument. And it's easy to observe in reality that the better integrated a player is with an instrument, the more beautiful the music becomes. So I was somewhat shocked to discover that those two components, the player and the instrument components, get locked together by the recording process. And at first I thought there was something wrong with the measurement or the instruments being used, but I discovered that the real problem is in the sample, not in the equipment, the devices or the process or the technique. And running that signal, running a music signal through a biphasic display clearly shows that the music we've always been listening to is only half of what was originally there. And that problem was made even worse when digital recording entered the picture and downgraded it even further when compression and encoding came along to make everything more convenient. So I'm not sure, I don't want to really get into any kind of conspiracy theories about what's been going on or anything, but I will say that it's an obvious fact that over the past 15 to 20 years, music has been continually downgraded to where now it's just a shadow of what it originally was. And the problem with that is that if you look up listen in the dictionary, so the definition of listen is to pay attention to, give heed to be aware of, and it's obvious to me that this has become a major problem in the world because people are not paying attention, they're not giving heed to, and they're not being aware of. And I believe a lot of it has to do with the fact that we spend so much of our time listening to music. The current statistics are showing something like 5 to 8 hours a day we're listening to music. Maybe not specifically to listen to the music, but on the radio or on the TV or in the stores or on your radio in your car or whatever. We listen to music a lot, and so it takes up a third of our lives. And I believe that the fact that it's been degraded to this point to where people don't really even listen to it anymore, they just use it to block off the outside noise. They're not really listening to the music anymore because it doesn't appeal to them anymore. It doesn't put goosebumps on them anymore. It doesn't grab them like music used to grab us. So it's sort of become my new goal, my new purpose is to save the music. And so we're starting foundations and designing technology that can solve this problem and bring back the music to the level that it was intended to be by the artist who performed it.
Mm.
So, Joseph, I don't know if you want to join me in my little
yes, definitely.
My new foundation to save the music, but I think it's really, really important that we do this.
Yeah, definitely. I fully agree with you in that sense because basically through the processes, like in 1993, I developed a holographic sound technology to basically treat my post-traumatic stress. And by 92, I developed a sound bed to do exactly that process, to apply the correct harmonics to my body. And I had severe damage. I mean, from the car wreck that I was in 1984, I had extensive tibia damage and ankle. And I mean, I honestly looked like the elephant man in many ways. And I know that I was suffering, and the basic doctor said I would not walk properly again, and the neurological damage was permanent, and you know, painkillers and things like this. And that depression that set in afterwards was pretty bad. But getting back to the sound, when I was exposed to the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra, which was a live event, it was the first time in over a year after the incident that I had actual relief. I actually felt relief from the pain. And my mind was able to actually completely kind of engross itself in listening, paying attention to that symphony. And I was in euphoria. I mean, you know, before the concert, I was honestly in agony. And then during the concert, I was in euphoria. And I thought, okay, what is this? Because anything that I tried to listen to, like a home stereo or any kind of recorded, processed sound, I was honestly feeling ill, violently ill. And I could never explain that. Over that period of that time when I was in that post-traumatic state, anytime I listened to anything that was electronic, anything that came through a stereo, anything like that, I was just honestly almost to the point of being violently ill, and I thought, that's just crazy. And then wondered what the exposure to the symphony was, this antidote, and I thought, okay, there's something that's just absolutely incredibly obvious to me, and I had to discover what that was. And what that journey led me on was the fact that what I discovered was all of the electronics that were being sold. And this was amazing because I found it so profound that the simple thing of phase, the correct phase, the actual pressure wave being generated by the speakers was actually being put in reverse phase by the manufacturers of the amplifiers and also the preamplifiers and everything electronic that was being produced for the public. I could walk into a room, and the moment they turned on any kind of electronic media, I could tell instantly it was the wrong phase. It was antagonistic. And I thought,
right,
that's bizarre. And so I went, and I literally bought, I started purchasing some really high-end, like Martin Logan's and Mark Levinson's, and I mean really high-end audio gear, and I would open them up, and I would do a signal trace on them, and every one of them, the output phase was always 180 degrees out of correct phase. And I thought, what the heck is going on? How is this possible? Why would they be doing this? And then it's like, interesting, would this be because of ignorance and not knowing, or is this part of a processed mandate? And for me, it became pretty obvious after a while that it was something that was an industry standard.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, isn't this funny? So I went and I redesigned, and I literally redesigned my own preamplification system. I redesigned my own amplification system. I went away from your standard push-pull configurations. I went to pure Class A, and I absolutely checked the phase output of the actual amplifier at the end to make sure that it was in the correct phase, and then my speakers as well, because I found most of the manufacturers were actually putting the bass component, the bass speaker, in the cabinets purposefully out of phase with the mid-range and the high-end. And it's like, why would you do that? That makes no sense. Well,
yeah,
it doesn't make any sense. If you look at it on the technical side, though, if you have an other purpose in mind, then it does make sense. Basically, what you're doing is creating a phase distortion. In other words, you're putting a a whip effect, a frequency whip effect into the harmonics so that there's a destruction happening at certain nodes. In other words, those areas, like let's say at 500 cycles, there'll be an antinode, and 1,000 cycles, there'll be another antinode, and 2,000 cycles, another antinode, and then 4,000 cycles, and so on and so forth. So basically, through the total harmonic scale of the 10 octaves, you've destroyed, in every octave, you destroyed a specific targeted area. And I thought, that's insidious. How could they do this? And then it became crystal clear, because when I created in 92, when I actually created my first sound bed with the proper phase correct preamplification, amplification, equalization stages, all these things, when I laid on that bed, or when I should say, I'll remove myself from the equation, when I had my guests come and lay on the bed, they would go into an altered state in literally minutes. I had even Dr. Beverly Rubik come up from Temple, from HeartMath. She came up to Vancouver because she heard about what I was doing, and she wanted to experience it for herself. And in 15 minutes, she came off the soundbed, and she basically looked at me, and she says, that was the most deep, profound experience I've ever had on anything like this. She says, that was amazing. She said, it was in seconds I was in an altered state.
I've been blown away. I've been blown away asking people if they if music ever puts goosebumps on them, and I was just blown away by how many people would tell, you know, would kind of shrug their shoulders and say, "No, I'm not. I don't know what you're talking about." And I'm saying, "You've never had music put goosebumps on you? You've never been in the car and a particular song comes on that speaks to a moment that you're in emotionally and it puts goosebumps on your body?" And they say no. And I'm stunned that people don't have that kind of experience with music anymore.
Yeah, it's quite a disconnect. Well, with the sound bed, what I noticed most people for their first session, they would honestly, they would do shallow breathing and they'd be very rigid. And by the time they had their second experience on the sound bed, I would invite them to breathe deeply, and if they felt any tightness, shake it out. And it was amazing how in a very short period they would actually go through a process where it looked like just like an animal that's been attacked or hit, where they all of a sudden they shake violently and then they're back to normal. And I would be witnessing this event happening with people, and I knew right there. It was the release of the trauma at the cellular level.
Right.
And I had clients for years who basically came almost monthly like a ritual. I need my tune-up. I want to listen to Tchaikovsky, or I want to listen to Mozart. And I mean, I could run volume levels, like very, very profound volume levels of 104 to 110, 112 decibels, which is very loud. But I could have a conversation with them while those volumes were being played. They could hear me totally clean in a calm voice because there's no distortion, there's no phase distortion, so my voice would not be interfered with, and we could have a gentle conversation while these very powerful sound pressure levels were going right through their bodies.
Right. Well, that's the main discovery that we made with our supercomputer, is that most sound engineers really only know phase as the condensers on a speaker. So you got your positive pole and your negative pole, and you flip those around, and it's 180 degrees out of phase, and that's really all they know of phase. No one's really talking about all the other degrees of phase. That's really where the answer is. And everybody in our industry right now is really hung up on this idea about frequency. Everything has a frequency. They're not realizing that frequency is really just a carrier wave. It's a minor component of the whole signal. The main component is the phase and the magnitude. And those come from other sources that really relate all the way back down to that player and instrument level. And so when we get that straightened out, then you have those kind of experiences like you're talking about. And we've had those too over the years on our Vibrasound sound table, to where we've turn the body fluid into a speaker, and you do that in the proper phase, and it has profound effects on people that really are just off the scale on the different things that we've seen come from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. No, it's very impressive. I mean, I was exposed to I think they're called the Gyotone monks that come from Tibet, and they do the overtone chanting.
Right.
in their presence, there was nine of them, and they had the long trumpets and the drums, and they were doing the Heart Sutra. And, you know, normally when you buy a recording, like a CD recording, it sounds very pleasant, and it's nice. It's one of those things where it's very healing to listen to. But when you go and you actually experience it live, it shifts you so dramatically out of your confines of your five senses, because all of a sudden you actually feel this incredible pressure wave, this energetic pressure wave in the room, and it's actually breathing, it's alive. And, you know, I was there for, it was a 90-minute presentation, and I honestly lost the total sensation of gravity in the room. I was not being sucked down in my chair that I normally feel all the time, the pressure of my butt sitting on a chair, my back, and all these the compression of the gravity. In that 90-minute presentation, it was amazing that the feeling of gravity stopped. I was honestly at a point of weightlessness through the entire performance, and I thought that was the most impressive experience in my life.
It's funny it's funny how pressure and gravity are more or less the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You get thinking about that. You and I could have some long talks about that. But here's the thing. I can't wait to show you what we've discovered here, Joseph, because we figured out what the problem is, and all of those spatial characteristics that you're talking about from a live performance. You know, in a live performance, you've got hundreds of point sources of sound coming at you. You've got the whole stage is full of musicians and instruments, and even a piano has 88 keys or 88 strings on it. So you've got 88 waves coming at you there. And all that's coming up of all these different players and instruments, and it's bouncing off of all the walls, and it's changing the phase. Every time it hits the wall and bounces off, it changes the phase a little bit. And all that's coming back and hitting you from every angle like that. But when they record that, it brings every bit of that down to two point sources. But strangely, and very strangely, all of that spatial characteristic information is right there on the recorded signal. It's just been locked away. No one's ever heard it. It's on the CD. It's on everybody's iPod. But no one's ever heard it before. And so it's a simple matter of unlocking that. And when you do, it's back to live again. It'll take like an old Motown record and make it sound like the artist is re-recording it right next to you in the same room. So it's pretty amazing when you get down to this concept of phase and unlocking the phase. It gets us back to that real thing that you're talking about where you feel it in your body, you feel it in the skin, and you get those goosebumps all over you. So I'm really excited to show it to you.
I would love to see that. I am definitely interested. It was a company called High Definition Audio that is still selling on the internet a little device that does something interesting. It reminds me of that Barkus Berry device, you know, where it tweaked the phase of the high frequency, but it was still synthetic. You could tell it was edgy. It wasn't clean. It didn't sound natural. It didn't have the right depth of the ambience.
Well, this new process is totally clean because you can do a spectral analysis before and after, and you see that it doesn't change the spectral analysis at all. It doesn't change the spectral signature of the source at all. It just enhances it by unlocking it and providing twice as many partials, because half of them are locked away in the recording process. So it doesn't really get louder. It makes it denser. It makes it twice as many partials. And that's why a recording never sounds like a live presentation, because only half the music. So the big question is, how do we wake people up to the fact that they're not listening appropriately? How do we convince them that all these MP3s and this assembly of the sound that they've been experiencing over the years, how do we convince them that that's affecting them in bad ways and making them not even really want to listen to the music anymore? I want to show people there's a new way to listen. There's a new way that they can pay attention and be aware of things and give regard to other people and things. How can we do that?
Yeah, I think that's the quintessential the quandary, the question, how. Because I know with one of the things when we had the Sonic Temple, I ran a facility called the Sonic Temple for 3 years, and we had my sound system in there, and we had a very large sound bed, a 12-foot diameter one, and we also had my prototype, which was the one I built in 92. And it was amazing because people would come in with their MP3 players, and they'd say, oh, I have this beautiful piece of music. Can you please play it through the system? And I would go, oh, yeah, no problem. And we'd plug it in. And the moment we turned it on, people would actually say, what is that? And I go, well, that's the distortion. That's the noise. That's the actual artifacts that you're hearing from the MP3 process. And honestly, it was amazing how many people responded by saying, please turn that off. It sounds awful. Because the moment I would put on an audiophile CD, and I always had this one key which I found was absolutely brilliant. I had a very high-quality tube buffer stage, which went right after the CD player. In other words, and I had a reference CD player. I had a Technics unit which had dual 18-bit Burr Brown converter chips. In other words, it was a 36-bit unit running as a 16-bit. And it was amazing because it was able to take as much of the information, and then it would go through this this Class A tube buffer stage. And tubes do an amazing things with certain things like harmonics. Yeah. Tubes, because they work in the etheric field, and the etheric field is into the conscious field. It's into, you know, you can say God field if you want. And basically, anything that goes into that field, if it's an artifact that's an abstract, that's artificial, it doesn't exist anymore. Because that field will only bring back into existence that which is correct and in alignment with the correctness of time and space. And so that tube buffer stage was an amazing filter because it took out anything that was like a digital artifact that didn't belong, that was not natural. It basically removed it, and then it brought back correct, proper harmonics. And this is an interesting thing. Most people don't really understand about harmonics. In nature, if you ring a bell at 1,000 cycles, it's going to naturally have resonant frequencies that go up and down the scale in through the octaves. Tubes do the exact same thing. That's why a lot of the real high-end, very, very expensive equipment, such as amplifiers, the Class A amplifiers, are all tube stage because they actually work with the field correctly. Solid state is a synthetic. It's a reproduction, not production. It's a reproduction, and that's why when you get into the super high-end audiophile stuff, you don't see solid state. You see tubes, and it's interesting because when I put a real masterpiece like something that was recorded in 96 kilohertz, the bit rate way off the scale, and I put it through the system and played it, people actually sat there in shock because it would sound like the symphony was actually in front of them. That when the person would play a chime on the recording, the chime was in the room. When a person was playing like Strauss Blue Danube, where he's doing the violin, right, that part, people actually would literally open up their eyes and look in the general direction of where that violin player should be, because that violin player was in the room. And this was that comparative of playing that MP3 and then playing a real recording through that proper equipment. You know, it's just like that. There is a huge difference between correct, natural sound and then this MP3 thing that they're just basically duping everybody into believing that that's sound, and it's not.
Right. Well, the problem, of course, with all of that is that what you're talking about, equipment that you're talking about there, is extremely expensive, way out of the range of the average person. But what if there was a way around that? What if I were to say that since the whole problem that gets caused is with phase, if you straighten the phase process out, that solves the problem. So what if there was a way that for less than $10 I could make everybody's iTunes sound correct again?
Don, so I'm so there with you. It's like, let's do it.
That's what I'm doing right now. I'm actually talking to you through an iPhone that has this process in it now. And it's just the most amazing thing. It makes it sound like the band standing right next to you, like you're right in the room with them. In fact, when you turn it off, you can tell the real difference between stereo and live is that when you're in stereo, it's like you walk outside of the room and you're listening to the sound come out of two doors. When you walk back into the room, it's all around you. And this is all a matter of phase. And now, since we figured it out, that phase is much more than 0 and 180 degrees. It's all of the phase. And that's really what's happening in live performance. The listener has access to all of the different phases, bouncing off of the walls and all of that sort of stuff. Well, now we figured out that that's really just locked away. It's right there on the CD. It's right there. Unfortunately, it's not on the MP3 because the MP3 chops it all out, and it's not even there to begin with. So what we have to do in that case is we have to be able to figure out what's missing and then just put it back in. So we can do that, and we can make an MP3 sound better than a WAV file. So it's pretty amazing what the technology has come to. And I'm just about to get cranked up to really get out to bring this to the world and save the music, because I have a feeling this has been one of the major ways that you-know-who has been affecting the world and controlling the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I must agree.
I have a question for you guys. Can you hear me? I'm back on.
Yes.
Yes.
But here's a question, just for the sound quality. I get the echo when I'm listening to Dawn, but I don't get it when I'm listening to Joseph. But now I'm listening, and I can hear myself, and it sounds that way. How is it for you guys?
I don't hear it with Joseph, but I hear it with you. And I'm on a headset. I'm not on a speaker.
You're on a what, Dawn?
I'm on a headset, not speaker, so you can't hear my speakers or my headphones.
Yeah, I'm the same. I'm just wondering what the technical thing. So anyway, okay. I just think it's funny. We're doing a sound show and we're having technical sound difficulties.
I'm hoping that your people listening aren't getting this echo.
Well, we might have to re-record this one again because I'm not sure how else to deal with it. I've got my phone line redone, so I'm fine. So, anyway, but we'll continue on and we'll see what it translates like. And if we need to re-record it, we'll do that because I think what you guys are saying is quite profound. I have a question for you guys. You're talking a lot about the consciousness and what it's doing to consciousness. Did I miss that part while I was trying to deal with my dilemma?
We really haven't gotten too much into the whole consciousness part. I just simply mentioned that the definition of listening is paying attention to and being aware of and even giving consideration of to other people. So we were just talking about how a lot of that's been lost in the world because it's not being brought about by the music. You know, when I was a kid, we used to line our walls with the speakers, and the more speakers, the better. And we would run out, everybody that made a new processor, we would run out to get the new processor to make the sound better because we knew that the recording that we were hearing didn't have the same effect on it as the live performance did, as Joseph was talking about. Everybody's known that. So I think lately this, what I've been calling sci-fi sound is the answer to it all. It solves it all because it replaces all of that. It rejuvenates the music back to the way it was when it was live. So we've got to do something to get people to feeling the music again, the way that the artist felt it when the artist performed it. That's really what the artist wants. They want the person that's listening to it to feel the same way that they felt when they made it. But that's not
happening.
Well,
here's the question. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Last week I had Freddie Silva on, and we talked about what the whole purpose of a mosque or a temple or the cathedrals were, and the body, and it was made in the shape of the body. And the body, and when they went in, they were literally sound chambers mimicking our own bodies' essence.
And so our whole bodies are literal sound chambers, and obviously we're not chiming to the right beats. And so, like you're saying, Don, and I know this is very passionate for Joseph, how do we get back to the knowingness of how to put ourselves back in sync? Because it is what heals us, and it is these vibrations and resonances of what take us out.
There's two problems that I see right now that really stand in our way of doing that. One is industry related, and the other is consumer related. The consumers have this new, especially the young generation, have this this attitude that everything should be free, and the corporations are beginning to realize, well, this is our way to get more customers. So what they do is they make all of their cheapest stuff free, and it runs everybody else out of business. Because they're giving it away free, and apparently the kids don't really know the difference enough between the music to realize that what they're getting is really not worth it, even it being free, and so they go for it. And then the other problem is that, so it's a matter of convenience, so and the other problem is on the other end, on the industry end, there's two problems there. One is that convenience, they want a way to send things over the internet and store things without taking up so much space. That's one problem. And then the bigger problem is that why should a record company pay $150,000 for a quality album to be made in a quality studio where all these factors can be controlled? Why would they pay $150,000 to do that when they can pay somebody that considers themselves a poet to go buy a $200 or $300 piece of equipment that they can take into their bedroom, and they can steal a mono track from somebody else's free recording and make a sample out of it, and then stick a few words on it, a few rap words on it, and then produce it right in their bedroom, and the music industry can pay them $10,000 for that instead of $150,000. Why would they do that? So these are all big problems in our face of how do we stop it. We've got to convince people that quality is superior to convenience, for one thing, and we've got to convince the new generation coming up that everything's not supposed to be free. There's no such thing as a free lunch. And we've got to convince people that what's being touted as music right now isn't really even music.
It sounds like we need to go back to the core of the soul of understanding why we're even here and why we exist.
Exactly. But how do we get to people that aren't even listening anymore? That's our main problem right now is that the power structure has them to where they're not really even listening. So how do you get the message across to them if they're not listening?
You know what it was? You know, Don, this goes back to the last issue we did on I Imagine, you know, the I Imagine issue. And I know Joseph has done the Sonic Temple, and I've had the experience, and they have been profound, where I've had those aha moments or those nirvana moments when you are in a space that is sacred. And I know you have the sensorium that you have. And I love my idea on the malls of education. And then what would be in the middle of all of these malls would be these sensorium with clean air, beautiful sound, and people could actually experience the difference.
Right.
That to me was like, when I saw you know, what was hiding back in one of your archives, I just like said, that's exactly what we need to do. We need to switch these malls of consumerism to malls of education. And if people can actually therefore experience it, then they could see it. But if they haven't had the before and after, it may be hard for them to comprehend.
Right. And, you know, it's also important that they're around other people and they see other people getting it and enjoying it, which is a thing that the Internet doesn't really provide them. You know, they're at home alone. But if they were in one of these facilities, like our Mind Wave store, our entertainment thing, or Joseph's Temple.
Yes? Don, did you cut out?
Yeah. No, I'm here. So if they were if they were to experience it like that, where they're with their friends and they could see other people enjoying it and getting it and everything, then they're more willing to say, okay, I get it too. I can join the group. So I think that
it could be the next hot thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's a new way for people to socialize.
It's more than that, too, because the other thing that keeps coming to me with a lot of the next books that people that I'll be interviewing is that whole sound and resonance, and resonance is a thing that heals, which I think, Joseph, you were talking about more in the beginning of the show, but I also know that's what your technology does, too, as well, Dawn. So this is not just an entertainment. It is truly a vibrational resonance that actually has a capacity to heal us. And
yeah, that's
you both have technologies. Yeah.
That's why we call it INNER, entertainment.
Right.
It's a form of serious entertainment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also healing. So I think, why don't we talk, because this goes into where we were going to talk about water as well. And water is the vehicle that is the means and the messenger for what transfers all of these frequencies throughout our body. It is literally a liquid tape recorder. So every vibration and every sound that we put into our beingness is what we literally swim in, drink in, and profoundly affects us. So when you're talking about music and the sounds that we take in, they are literally critical to our own vibrational essence and our existence. And
exactly.
I know, Dawn, you have the technology that you have, which is the portal that takes you from one to the other to help you resolve conflict. So why don't you talk a little bit about the portal?
Yeah, when we were doing the portal, we made an amazing discovery that from our supercomputer, which data mines the Internet 24/7, it came back after Dr. Emoto made all of his pronouncements about water and how it holds energy and whatnot. It made it clear that when we were affecting change on a person, we were really affecting change on the water that was inside of them rather than the elements that were inside of them. And it came up with all kind of examples to prove that, such as if you remove the water from anything, it basically disassembles and just falls into dust. So in a number of other different ways, you can kind of show that it's the water that's holding the energy patterns. It's not really the elements that make us up. And as I also mentioned before, at the most basic level of reality, a human being is the same as a piece of music. It has an instrument component and a player component. We have this vehicle that we drive around, but we're the driver of it. We're a machine, but we're the operator of the machine. We have this personal aspect to ourselves and this impersonal aspect to ourselves. And the impersonal aspect of ourselves are those chambers that you mentioned, all those resonant chambers, our vocal cords and our resonant chambers inside of our body.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the instant aspects of ourselves. But as you're hearing me speak right now, that's not all that's coming from me. You hear the resonances of all of my resonant cavities in my vocal cords, but there's also another component going on there, which is how I'm thinking and feeling about what I'm talking about. I could leave that out, but I would sound like one of those guys on Battlestar Galactica who's really a computer and has no inflection in the voice. Or I could put a lot of that in my voice and make my voice very flowery and very passionate. But those sounds are actually coming from how I'm thinking and feeling about what I'm talking about. And so those two aspects represent who a person is as an instrument and who they are as the controller or the player of the instrument. So with our supercomputer technology, we're able to actually split those apart. We can take the attention from a person, remove the noise from it so that you only wind up with what's harmonic, and then separate those into these two components. And then feed one of them into one ear and the other back into the other ear, and it basically forces the brain to resolve the difference. It's similar to what's being talked about, binaural beats and entrainment and that sort of thing, but instead of using frequency, it uses phase. So in binaural beats, you've got two different frequencies, one different one in each ear, In our case, we have the same frequencies in each year, but they're out of phase with each other. One's carrying the player phase, and the other one's carrying the instrument phase. And as I mentioned earlier, it's very observable in nature that the more integrated a player is with an instrument, or an operator is with a machine, or a driver is with a vehicle, the better the result. The more beautiful the music, the less the machine breaks, the more integrated everything is, the better the results is. So that's an observable thing in nature. And so we know that that's true of human. We know that that's true of the human being, that all human suffering stems from the difference between those two aspects of oneself. So the fortical is just a technique by which, and a technology by which, a person can begin to learn that about themselves and learn how to resolve the difference between these two different aspects of themselves.
But your technology is kind of unique, Don, in the fact that what you're asking people to do is to tap in. You talk about the instrument and the player, and who's the instrument and who's the player. So you're saying basically if we're talking about the force or a god, whatever, the more we're in touch with that field and the more we're in line with it, the easier it is. So we're taking it up a notch to the level of consciousness, are we not?
Yeah, and it basically teaches you that it's okay to think anything. That's a totally imaginary thing, and it doesn't really cause anybody except yourself any kind of problem to think things or imagine things. But when you express them, when you bring them into reality by expressing them into the real world, you set into motion little tiny building blocks of matter that begin to combine themselves and gather themselves together to try to manifest what it is that you just said. And so once you learn that what you say is creating your reality, once you learn to master it, you can look at the portico and you can see whatever you want. You can rearrange the pixels and see any image that you want, because it's you that's creating the image. It's you that's creating everything that you see. And once you get to that level, you are able to actually create your own reality.
So when I, because I have, because you've, I have the portico, thank you. And
yes,
so ma'am. What I think is, what I think is beautiful about it, if we put all of these things together, we have our vehicle, which is our body, and we have our own sound chamber, which is our body, and within it resonates the water, which is mostly what it is, and with it we create shape, which is also its geometry, which reflects bit in and out of the world, and that is how we are known. So it's really important then to be mindful of what we think, what we speak, and who we swim with.
Yeah, and you find out that that's actually a cycle. It's what we call the cycle of manifestation that starts off with the thought or the intention. But that thought or the intention has to be expressed. You have to explain it to somebody else. You have to write down a plan. You have to draw a model of it. And then once it's been expressed, then you can take action on the expression. And then once you take action on the expression, you can cause it to manifest. And then even then, you still have to kind of nurture it and kind of keep it along to bring it into its fullness. So there's this whole cycle of manifestation. And what we find is, and what the portico basically reveals to a person, is where they get stuck in that cycle. Because what they find is that you'll find people that can think very clearly about things in their head, but they can't quite explain it to someone else. They can't express it. Or you'll find someone that talks all the time, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, but they never put it into action. Or you'll find someone who's moved into the action mode. I find this a lot. Somebody moves into the action mode and they're always doing something, but since they didn't express it correctly in the first place, it plays out on them and they just move on to something else. So you've got to get into this flow of things to where you're expressing, you're thinking, and then expressing, and then acting, and then manifesting, and then nurturing, and then thinking, and expressing, and acting, and manifesting, and nurturing. It's just a cycle of flowing in your life where you just flow from one thing that you're doing to the next thing that you're doing in this nice flow instead of getting stuck in one of those places. And the portico actually helps the person learn that about themselves. And it's because you can see in real time what's happening as you're expressing yourself into it.
I think what people need to visualize, because I think we need to put a picture to this. And so Don has created a model which out of a 12 torus sort of layered effect. Is that right, Don? It's a 12 torus layered effect.
Basically, what we do is the supercomputer can basically render a model of any real thing in a mathematical language and space that's so exact and so precise that the model is more or less the same thing as the thing that you're modeling. So you can take what a person says or a stated intention, and then you can model that mathematically into a 12-dimensional toroidal space. And then you can unfold that so that you can kind of see a cross-section of that. So you can see the distribution of all the phases within those 12 different dimensions. And as you can testify for yourself, Karen, it makes a very amazing, beautiful, mandalic kind of pattern.
Yeah, that's what I wanted him to hear.
And since it's running in real time, it continually changes as you express yourself into it. So you see this mandala that just continually unfolds in front of you. And if you were to master that, instead of just creating simple geometries like squares, circles, and six-pointed stars and sacred geometries like that, instead of that, once you master it, you're able to actually arrange the pixels however you want and create your own reality. It becomes like an intentional palette upon which someone can visualize their own intention.
Whoa. I have to say I have such fun playing with it, because you're supposed to, you know, that has the correlation of numbers and things with it, but that you can see where you are in this cycle of creating, which is kind of fun.
And suddenly, you know what, you realize you have this amazing realization. Suddenly you realize that everything is like that. When you're not using the cortical and you're just walking around in your life, everything that you see out there is just a bunch of pixels. And you're rearranging those pixels, and you've been told that that's a house, and that's a car, and that's a person, and that's a sheet of paper, or that's a phone, or whatever. You've been told that that's what that is. And so you see it as that. But it's important for everybody to realize that we're creating what we see. We're projecting it out. It's not out there anywhere. We're projecting it out, and we're rearranging all those pixels into what we're seeing.
Isn't that amazing?
Totally.
You know, when I see you know what you've done, and I've experienced my own self with the portical. And Joseph, you can pipe in here because you've actually had you've seen it with me, because I brought it to Las Vegas where we met that one time. And what I thought was so amazing was, if you look at the mosques and you do look at the stained glass windows, I love what they say is like with all of the mosaic patterns. That's Allah at rest. And then when all of a sudden when I look at your portical and how people can see that fractal geometry moving in space. Then you begin to see that our voices take on these shapes, which is the same thing as the snowflake, which is Emoto's work. And we can see that we are literally fractal geometry, electrically charged with electrical discharge patterns. And it is, you begin to see that what we bring charge to magnetizes into our life. We do it with sound, and we do it by holding it and carrying it in the water. It is so magnificent. You know, I'm going to go back to this, because Joseph is a really unusual character in one sense. He's the only person I know that we can call Felix the Cat, who has had 9 lives.
Mm-hmm.
Right, Joseph? And he's actually had 9 near-death experiences. So he has gone in and out of that veil, which is really what Don's portal does. It takes you to the other side of the veil and back inside to you. But Joseph has actually physically done that. And so, you know, Joseph, give us some insights from the other side that you've had, because I know they have been quite profound. We've had many conversations. Joseph is a very dear friend to me, and somebody who has guided me along the way to even get to the point where I could even discuss any of this stuff on a radio show. So, Joseph, give us some insights to what you see from the other side.
It's quite interesting in the sense that the journeys have never been the same. Like I could, you know, people say, well, each time that you remember being like on the other side of this veil, and it's amazing how that fractal aspect is such a profound memory for me that you know, the layering of that world or those worlds, because it is, it's multiplicity. It's not a one singularity that we go to. It's not like that at all. It's a multiplicity, and it was depending on where I was at. It was depending on what I was processing at the moment that actually then I interlaced into that experience and was able to witness, you know, it's like almost like with a microscope. At first level, when you're looking with your eyes and you look at your desk, you see the surface of the desk. And then if you take a good magnifying glass, you can see the surface with a lot more texture. And then if you take a microscope, you get to see all the little fungus and virus and bacteria crawling on the surface. And it looks like a unique world. And then when you get down onto the surface of one of those bacteria, there's another world. And then so on and so forth. So it's the relative magnification, right, is the reference to whatever world you're witnessing. And it's very much in that same light that I experienced those other dimensions as an aspect of a scale of observing that consciousness. Because I remember very distinctly in one experience being very much like the size of an atom, and watching the dynamic fields and the colors and the fields interact and blend and envelop and create these incredible, profound fractal images, just like, you know, the Mandelas and the rose windows and all those things that we tend to, you know, picture in our artwork, like especially like the Alex Gray kind of stuff. You know, that for me was a visceral experience of witnessing that level. And yet, I remember distinctly at one point in one of my experiences being in an environment where there were these, like, not physical bodies the way we look at bodies, humans, the way we have bodies here, but more like energy field bodies, these morphic representations, like what people classically would call an angel form, right, where it's a light body. It's this looks like a luminous teardrop and has that kind of effect. And each time the question I would always come back with was, you know, what was that? How can I relate that to what I'm experiencing in my world, in my physical life?
That background noise is so bizarre.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but it's annoying. Sorry.
Yeah, sounds like somebody's shuffling papers across the desk.
I know, and I'm really being quiet. Yeah. I'm sitting here very still.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess we have an anonymous listener who's frustrated or a little perturbed by what I'm sharing.
Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah.
But I love, you know, the idea of the teardrop, because the when I've seen Don's images of the portico, what he has is the torus field, and what's inside it is a person, and it's literally in a teardrop, isn't it, Don?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's actually – did you have the same sort of epiphany, and is that why it looks that way?
Yeah, exactly. It's,
okay.
It's, you know, you've seen my chart before. And,
I have.
And the chart basically is exactly what Joseph was describing. It's a scale of reality. And you follow that scale all the way down through those different levels that he was talking about, and the experience is different on each one. But you follow that all the way down one more step past where he was talking about, and you're down into what they call super strings now, where everything's not a particle, it's a string. And those strings are woven together like threads in a fabric to make up all the membranes in the universe. But if you go one step further, you find out that it's really a complex wave function. And if you go one step further, you find out that the complex wave function has sine wave and cosine wave functions. And if you go a step further, you find out that those functions are being multiplied by two other functions. That's basically the player and the instrument. And so all at the very most basic primary level of reality, you have these two multipliers that are controlling the wave function.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we've been doing is just separating those and feeding them back to a person where they have to integrate them. And then we made the same discovery that music has the same situation to work, but in that case, they're both locked together. So you unlock it, and it sounds live again. And then furthermore, if you ask water to do the same thing, if you ask water to resolve the difference between its real self and its imaginary self, or its body components and the information that's on it, if you ask it to resolve that, it goes through the same exact process that a human being does in transformation. It first has to acknowledge the need to change and then give up resistance to the change and remove all the unwholesome things that are in the way of making the change, and then having faith in letting go of the old and stepping out into the new level, which for water is vapor. For a human being, it'd be spirit. But for water, it's a vapor, and that's a metaphor of exactly what a human being goes through to achieve its next level of reality, which is spirit.
There was one near-death experience I know that Joseph has, and then I know Mike Waters is with us, and I'll introduce him, but I'm going to have Joseph, when Joseph had one other near-death experience, he discovered something about water that has been in a lot of the scriptures. You want to describe that one, Joseph? You know which one I'm talking about?
Yes.
The finer form of the other.
Yeah, in that process when I had transcended, when I was out of my body and I was in that stillness, in that and I will not call it the void because there's no such thing as the void. That's an illusion.
Okay.
When I was in the presence, what I was witnessing was this. The first was like what looked like I was looking at a lake, this beautiful lake of water, and I was thinking, well, that's a beautiful lake of water. And all of a sudden, and it was, you know, the classic God in my head voice, very angelic, profound, androgynous, but beautiful. And it basically says, I am the consciousness, the living force that exists on all the planet. I am what gives life to all things and all beings. And I was like, wow, and I'm in this profound state of gratitude listening to this. And then I'm going, okay, you know, like water. And then I hear, that's what you've named it, but it is not an it. And I'm like, okay. And the next thing you know, I'm seeing I'm turned into the sky, and I'm seeing the beautiful vault of the heavens, the azure blue, and I'm thinking, wow, that's a beautiful sky. And I'm hearing, no, that's a finer state of that which you just witnessed. And I went, oh, that's a finer state of the liquid. So air, the thing we call air, is actually not air. It's a finer state of water. It's a gaseous state of water. And I was like, yes, that's correct. Then the next thing you know, I'm punched out into the heavens, like into the far, far out, like 120,000 feet plus. So I'm just at the edge of the atmosphere, and I'm staring off and away from the sun into the space, and I'm seeing the movement of the light moving away from the sun, and I'm feeling this intense vertigo, this feeling of lost, like I'm so finite, I'm so tiny, I'm such an infinitely small aspect that I'm losing myself, and I'm actually in fear, and I'm thinking, well, that's the void, that's the nothing. And then I hear, no, that's another finer state of the first. There is no such thing as the void. And then my technological, my analytical side of my consciousness kicked in and went, remember that all of space is not empty. It's filled with the superfluid state of water. It's all water. There is nothing but water. And I was like, oh my God. And then I felt this smile come over me like, yes, now you finally realize the truth.
Mm.
John, you have something
beautiful.
You want to say about that?
That's just beautiful. The way he put that, it's so true. It's all just water.
Yeah, I have to say, I absolutely, all three men that are on the phone, I absolutely adore. They are some of my favorite people on the planet. They're people I talk to sometimes on a regular basis or not, and I am so thrilled to be able today to share them with you. And I think with the concept of water, we're going to introduce Mike Waters. And I think, you know, when I think of Mike, you know, he is a sustainable strategist. He is... And sorry, guys, I couldn't introduce you before. But thank you for introducing yourself. And but Mike is an advanced technology advisor, researcher, innovator, and sustainable recovery strategist. And in the last 10 years, Mike has done research on cutting-edge science, technologies, and refined current understanding of mainstream physics. So hi, Mike.
Hi, Karen. Hi, guys.
Mike?
Hello.
Yes.
He can say hi, guys, because we all talk. So and you know what? Here's the funny thing, Joseph, and it goes back to Mike. California is having this horrific water crisis. And Don, that's where you live. But what's so funny to me is I think what Mike says is there is no. How could you have? This is like upside down thinking. How can you have on a water planet a water problem? And when the whole ethers is filled with it, how is our thinking so upside down? So, Mike, I'm going to start with asking you that. How did our thinking get so upside down?
We seem to enjoy it.
Why is that?
I love the way Joseph portrayed the different states of matter and reality and how everything is essentially that substance. Call it water, call it whatever you will, but our whole concept of what matter is so typically governed by our magnification level. And so we perceive what we perceive, but our window is tiny, 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 normally. So it's nice to sort of push that window open a little bit.
Well, you say that this time we're facing the greatest convergence of global crisis in the history of our civilization. And it basically comes down to our two problems, the two fundamental thinking, two things that we fundamentally think that are wrong. You want to go into that? And guys, here's one second, Mike. Don, you guys are welcome to stay on. And Joseph, you're welcome to stay with us and continue, because I have to tell you, all of these guys can cross each other's borders in the sense of understanding physics, science, and all of these ways. So you're welcome to stay on, or if you have and you'd like to go, you're welcome to go. But I just wanted to at least invite you to stay and be part of the conversation if you want to with Mike. So anyway, I'll leave that with up to you. So
thank you.
Mike, go ahead. You're welcome. So what are the two fundamental ways that we think that are wrong?
And first, obviously, I've got a lot of respect for all three of you, two of my favorite people. well, as looking at it as a simplist, and obviously we can look at these things in lots of different ways, but just from the perspective of trying to simplify the problem so that it becomes somewhat manageable in people's minds, in their thoughts, I think there's a case to simplify what's going on down to two possible primary causes, one being our misconception of some very profound basic concepts of physics and energy, and then the other having a misconception at a very basic level about how nature operates. And so when it comes to nature, the concept that nature is competitive primarily is bad math. And the idea that energy is a finite resource and that we have to use this thing called fuel is a disastrous concept. Well, they're both disastrous concepts in the effect they have, because they're both contributory to termination of life. We're literally threatening our ecosystem with those concepts that are involved in many other concepts we have. So my basic point go ahead.
No. I was thinking of one thing that when I think of over the way you describe things is how we're literally burning up our planet, and with the way that we use the fuel we have and everything that it does, so that we have to drive it, we have to transport it, we have to dig it up, we have to do all these things. But when I listen to all three of you, it's available in the ethers. I think Tesla had that idea.
Yeah, I think that's one of the fundamental errors is that in a universe comprised primarily of energy, almost unlimited or unlimited, I mean, if you buy the concept that we're in an infinite universe, where as far as we can tell, space goes off forever, then every other concept should be considered first from being infinite, including scale. And here's the evidence right in front of us that the smaller you go, the more powerful things get. And yet we deny that when it comes to, gee, where would we find energy? Well, everywhere. So the whole concept of fuel is fundamentally flawed in that you're transporting something that's already everywhere you're going. It's essentially math. You know, just like running out of water on a planet covered in water. You know, another definition of insanity. So, I find it kind of humorous.
I think Joseph, were you going to say something about Tesla's technology?
Yeah,
because I know you have Tesla coils.
Because I've worked with a lot of Tesla's equipment, and one of the things, when I was doing the research on his life, he basically was quite adamant in the sense that he said that the indoctrinated poverty mentality is the absolute limiting force upon our consciousness. He said there is no, there's absolutely no no defined limit to the amount of energy. He said basically in his speech before the American Society of Sciences, and this was like 1900, right? He basically said that 1 cubic centimeter of space, in other words, at the Earth's surface, if we took 1 square centimeter and shielded it from the outside influences, the difference between the inside of that square and the outside was 800 million volts potential. 800 million volts potential. And now we're looking at this thing of, well, we need to dig up oil. We need to, you know, use wind. We need to use solar. And the fact is, in what he was defining to, what he was referring to, was the fact that in the air you have water vapor. In that molecule of water vapor, you have a hydrogen and oxygen relationship. That relationship is an oscillating relationship, one of gases being imploded to water, water disassociating to gases, being imploded back to water, and that oscillation can be captured. There's a company called Blacklight Energy that is now basically not only proven that fact, that they can get an incredible amount of energy out of that process, but it's exactly what Tesla claimed back at 1900. That, and even Jules Verne, in his early books, he referred to that the new era, the new age which will awaken humanity, will be the hydrogen era based on water being the fuel.
Mm.
So there is no shortage of energy on the planet. There's only the indoctrinated mental poverty by the scientific community at large, and anybody who tries to do research in this other side is quickly, look at Pons and Fleischmann, they were exterminated, right? Eugene Maloff was murdered. I mean, people who start to show that, yes, water is the fuel, water is the truth, the suppression comes like a tidal wave. And it's all because the fear is we won't dig any more oil or coal or anything because we won't need it. The fact is we haven't needed it for 100 years plus. It's just the status quo that wants to basically keep, honestly, leeching off the politics and off the population to keep us in a debt slave mentality while we're killing the very life force of the planet, which is called the ecosphere. So
the problem.
Go ahead.
I was going to say the problem seems to be, though, with the people. The universe allows a person to have leisure time when they show evidence that they can properly use it. The universe isn't based on law. It's based on liberty. The laws are only there to restrict the actions of unconscious people. And so we have all these laws on us now that are keeping us from growing, but it's only because if the people had that much leisure time, if you took all their jobs away and gave them free energy and gave them leisure time, they would just get in trouble with it. So the problem is really basically with the people. And when the people, whom we can change the people, then they can have access to all these technologies. So that's been my approach, is really to try to get down to their level and convince them that the real energy crisis is right inside their own body.
Yes.
Well, that goes back. Let me go back to Mike, because Mike's basically talking about the way nature is it structures itself, and the way we're doing it is this competitive domain instead of a cooperative. So why don't you take it from there 1 second, Mike?
Sure. And let's face it, anything when we talk about individuals, we're also talking about community and environment because it's interactive. So what I look at all these things, and what Don mentions and what Joseph mentions, and Blacklight Power is an example, actually, of the whole dynamic. We could get into more about them, but there's no need. There's many examples of essentially economically free energy. But this interactive environment, I think J.P. Morgan is a good example. You have so often a culture that motivates certain kinds of behaviors, in this case, predatory. So you're breeding this kind of destructive behavior, which then behaves that way and with predictable results. All these are symptomatic of a competitive dominant system. Now, a competitive dominant biological system is self-destructive. You're talking about a basic biological math where there's a single winner. And when you have a single winner, it's going to die because it's out of resource. Nature is the exact opposite of that. It's collaborative, and collaboration leads to diversity, decentralization, and abundance within, you know, this conscious matrix. And so one of the things we need to learn, and again, it's a very interactive situation. On the one hand, you introduce, quote, free energy into a culture that is used to being competitive dominant, you're going to have a rough transition. But at the same time, if you don't, you're going to have a rough transition towards death. So you have this situation where you have to holistically turn things around. And that's when I guess the main point of my research and the conclusions are that if you're going to handle the incredibly complex interactive dynamics of a global system that needs to heal, you have to understand the basic laws that are motivating where you got to and what basic laws will motivate your way out of it. And so looking at all these systemic failures and possibilities, opportunities, my approach has been to simplify it down to the most basic common denominators I could, which are misunderstanding energy and misunderstanding nature. So, okay, that's a basic construct, but now where do we go from here? For me, you know, there's no question that, especially in the American culture, dealing with a lot of egotistical-based behavior, which manifests all the negative emotions often, as we know, greed, jealousy, fear, et cetera, apathy. So what I'm doing as much as possible, but you know, a lot of this stuff I could say just go to my website and there's my basic philosophy, et cetera, but something that isn't on that site is my primary focus these days, which is getting as many inventors, researchers, teams with breakthroughs in physics and energy and other areas to collaborate as much as possible, or at least say we're an alliance or we're aligned, because there's enough resistance out there as it is without introducing another fracturing concept of competition of emerging technologies in energy. It's been one of the easiest ways to prevent such technologies from coming out. So I do believe very strongly in getting as much collaboration as possible between emerging technologies. And there's a compelling argument for that, which basically says that competing with technologies that have such a profound advantage economically if you want to look at it from a profit motive, competitive motive perspective. Competing with these systems is profoundly bad math, because you could have 1,000 companies or entities competing with free energy systems, and they wouldn't make a dent for years. So that's basically the premise, is trying to get as much collaboration in this field as possible. And sometimes it does feel a little daunting because of ego.
Well, Mike, is it possibly also because, you know, with the economic situation the way it is, how does an inventor then get remunerated for what it is that he's done so he can provide his own livelihood? I think that's really at the crux of all of this, isn't it? Is the fear, still the fear base of how do we survive? Because a lot of the scientists and a lot of us have not, you know, maybe financially have the wherewithal to get it all out. So I understand the collaborative thing, but how do you see that in one sense working?
I think that's a very good question, because yet again, operating with common sense and logic is often difficult to do when you're in an insane culture. So what would make sense would be to say, okay, guys, look, we're entering a future of abundance, because the very basis of a free energy culture is abundance. That's an abundant economic system. You're starting with abundance as your most basic concept, and you're building out from there. Whereas our current culture is we start with lack, we start with death, and then we destroy out from there. So what makes sense is actually to put the information out there, have enough people rally around you to say, this guy or this girl or this entity thought of this, and we need to really support them and make sure that they benefit from that. But all the fear in people says, okay, we've got to protect this idea, this technology. We need to make sure we get patent protection. We need to make sure that we lock up the legal side of this like a vault before we release it to the world and try and do good with it. And then predictably what happens is we'll try suing the Chinese, not getting noticed by those who have set up the patent process specifically to notice the emerging technologies before everybody else, so they can do something about it if they choose. And you can go on with all the reasons, all the multitude of reasons, that no free energy technology has come to world recognition in the last 150 years, despite how many, possibly hundreds of times it should have done.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me. You and I have both seen... Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, please.
I thought you were done with your thought, but if you're not, finished, please.
Well, I guess to answer the question, my belief is, and what I'm trying to accomplish, is aligning even more so that we're... forming alliances with, say, wind and solar companies and projects, so that they go ahead and get contracts to produce power to the grid, and then you start embedding these kinds of technologies within that structure and within that funding. And then hopefully you're generating income streams which then support the emergence, as kind of possible emergence of these technologies as you can. Because there is a flip side, obviously. It's back to what I akin to tossing a loaded gun into a cage full of monkeys. There are lots of incorrect ways to transition between a debt-based economy and an abundance-based economy, just as there are many, many beneficial ways.
Well, I know you've strategized how to do that, and I know you've done that, and you've seen it in layers. I know that from conversations we've had. Do you care to talk about that, or... Shall we move to the idea of patents? Because I can do patents, no problem.
Well, and this is all based on the premise that I hope I'm right. My father was very heavily involved in library disaster recovery and conservation, and he's, I guess, a lot of respect for him. He was known as the father of book conservation, library conservation. There's a lot of parallel between that kind of work and how you handle a planet, and that is to address the issue in a phased approach where you start with triage and you end up with the ultimately sustainable process. So right now we've got a number of situations that require urgent attention. And if we list it all, we'll just get all depressed and hang up. But just say we're dealing with a lot of different crises and we need to address the most urgent first. But all the while, trying to play the chess game of being aware enough about the implications of all the actions you take. So, I mean, let's take a look at energy itself, because it is such a hinge pin to all of this. Because, you know, if you've got energy, you've got water, you've got food. It doesn't matter where you are. That's a basic premise. And the economic impact is fairly obvious on the positive side. The negative side isn't quite as obvious, and it's more to do with transition. So, you know, if you suddenly just open source a technology, things could move very rapidly, but rapid isn't always the friendliest direction to go. It isn't always the most positive for everybody. But sometimes you're forced to be backed into that corner. So it's going to be very interesting this year, because I do see that this may actually be the year that economically free energy does emerge. There's so many now starting to come out that I really do believe we're at that time. And it's going to be a very exciting time. But hopefully there'll be more positive things that happen as a result than negative in the short term.
Yeah, I think that's what Joseph was saying. He said he sees so many emerging technologies. Like you're that's what you do, Mike. You're interfacing with people all the time with these technologies, and you're trying to put them all together. So, Joseph, you're in the same mode, that it's going to be a flood and no way to hold it back?
My feeling is that that's happening all over the planet, because the sheer magnitude of the discoveries to do with simple things like the real dynamics of water, the real dynamics of magnetism, the real dynamics, because, again, it's that perceptional that shift that's happening. People are basically looking at the potential, the possibilities, rather than what can't be done, because that's what's been taught for over 100 years plus, right? What can't be done.
Right.
These are why you know, in systems they teach what are the laws of nature, the laws of this, the limiting factors, when the fact is it's only limited to what we can perceive. Because,
right.
I mean, we've seen it over and over. We've seen developments happen over and over, all over the planet. I saw a video from Pakistan, a small four-rotor magnetic generator producing over 3 kilowatts of electricity just simply on magnetic repulsion. And it was done in a very, very inexpensive garage. And the gentleman basically demonstrates it on the floor of this I think it's in Pakistan, actually. But anyhow, he demonstrates how he built this thing very simply, and it produces rotary motion, and there is no input power. There is no other wires leading to the machine. You can see it. It's simply done on repulsion. So, you know, I see this there's this threshold that's happening, you know, this point of no return, where basically, you know, the suppression, because, I mean, even on the patents, I know people on the inside at the highest levels who basically are saying, you know, that over 5,000 patents to do with free energy or over unity or zero-point energy have been sequestered under national security. And it's like, well, yeah, that's a vested interest, basically saying, no, we can't have that out there. It's going to interfere with our oil or our nuclear or whatever it is. So, you know, at a certain point, the sheer volume of consciousness, the sheer volume of numbers will supersede the ability of the suppression. And that's an inevitable truth.
And I think that's what you're saying, is if you get all of the people out there on some, you know, one website or whatever, at least it starts connecting and putting it out there.
Yes, and there's some pitfalls in that. Unfortunately, 95, being optimistic, 98% pessimistic of the claims of the YouTube videos of the the people out there, from my experience, are either delusion, fraud, wishful thinking. But that still, that 2%, that 5%, is literally world-changing. And the difficulty for people in this field that do what I do is to discern. And to discern, you have to understand the most primary rules that you're dealing with, because there is so much to filter through to identify what's actually working. But because of that, it opens up some profound windows that become incredibly obvious. And I've got my favorite list of just logic that is undeniable, but it's not easily thought of until it's pointed out. And yet you can tell it to a physicist or a child and they'll get it. So it's interesting how we set up our blocks. Huh?
Yeah, you have a new formula. You had a formula in the sustainability issue where it had to do with the physics. Why don't you explain that? Because it kind of says we've been thinking, and the way it defies the laws as we have been taught, like Joseph and you are saying, that you came up with a new formula that explains and debunks all of them, and then you basically say, if it's so easy to see, why have not we seen it before? So why don't you explain the formula? That's upside down,
too. I'll try and make this quick. But starting, it starts in a way with the wind industry as a good example of how so many physicists, aerodynamicists, engineers can be profoundly wrong about the most basic pursuit of what they're doing. That same formula, funnily enough, gives us a very simple way of explaining so-called overunity or tapping a less-known energy source, or keeping in mind that everything in our universe is energy with energy infinite potential. So, very basic concepts here. The formula is very easily demonstrated by just one of the technologies, which is called a mist system. And essentially, all you're doing is taking a water molecule again. I'm sure Joseph would like that. And accelerating it to fairly high velocity, far, far slower than you're using in a water jet cutter, for instance, which is commonly done all over the planet. But accelerating it to a speed that's high enough to achieve the purpose, you run it, then you accelerate it and then impact it onto a surface at right angles. Now, as that then creates this shock wave, like a mushroom cloud expanding out from that event. And what happens is it happens so fast that you're literally creating an implosive force. In other words, at the core of that expanding donut, just imagine how much the pressure must be dropping, how much the humidity must be dropping. And what you actually get all in one fell swoop is everything's expanding outwards. Oxygen separates from hydrogen in the water molecule. You get lightning effects because of the incredibly high static charge and low humidity. And the result is you get a whole bunch of heat and you get a whole bunch of steam. Okay? Or you get a whole bunch of pressure as well as you get more and more into the hydrogen oxygen. And all of this is actually centering around what I call inertial chemistry. And this is, you can see how much that is overlooked as a term, because you won't find a single Google reference to inertial chemistry. And yet it's fundamental to so much of what's going on in the universe. And what I mean by that is, you can take a certain frequency and cause something to vibrate to destruction, like a wine glass, right? Or you can do the same thing to a nucleus. You can do the same thing to an electron field. You can do the same thing to a molecule. So in the case of this system, where we're simply slamming water into a surface and letting it expand out, and that causes separation without standard electrolysis with all the inefficiency claims attached, right? What you're really doing is you're using inertial chemistry on one side of the formula and conventional chemistry as the oxygen hydrogen comes slamming back together again on the other. And that's called a closed loop, because you're not burning water. It's not disappearing. You're simply using the same atoms over and over again in the closed loop cycle. The water is essentially being used like an amplifier. So that's a very simple example of this amplification formula, which is essentially the opposite of aviation. In aviation, it's known that drag increases by the velocity. It increases by the square or cube, depending on your point of view. Well, force is doing the same thing. So like with a wind turbine, it's the opposite of an aircraft. And what's interesting is the wind industry has copied aircraft aerodynamics, which is the exact opposite of what they should do, which hence brings up the lesson of how an entire industry can be wrong. But that formula, very, very simple, force increases by the square with velocity, is being used in this very simple and elegant way with the example I gave, simply slamming water into a surface. So force increases by the square of velocity is now a very simple way to describe how you can get, quote, over unity without having to come up with a lot of complex math. And so that's essentially what I did by using the wind industry and some of these examples.
You know, when you describe the first part, it almost described like exactly what the guys were talking about with the whole notion of sound and what would happen inside a human body. Am I correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, everything is
still from the inside
matter
out.
Matter is energy. Sorry, what?
Yeah. No. It was just a visualization that was going on in my head. Go ahead.
Matter is energy. Energy is consciousness. Right? Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
It's going to be interesting when you and I really get to spend some time together, because we've actually been going the opposite direction, and our process inflows the water, cavitates it inwardly. And so I'd love to have your input on our process and maybe how that all comes together at some point.
Oh, I would agree. I mean, toroids can go both ways, right? So if you look at like NanoSpire or Peter Greneau or Neil Greneau's work, where you and I'm sure that's similar to, again, what you're doing, where you're creating a toroid, which then creates a linear, like a laser pulse, right? And then in this process, we're doing the exact opposite. We're starting with the like a laser pulse, and that's terminating in a toroid. But interesting
right.
that energy is released in both methods.
And right.
not only that, you're getting alchemic reactions occurring as well, because this
right.
is inertial chemistry again.
You know what a trimeter is? I can take a trimeter out into the parking lot of the building where this Olympic is, and when it's running, after it goes through phase transition, you can measure an electric field in the air, not a magnetic field, but an electric field in the air hundreds of feet away from this thing.
And I bet you would agree that, you know, magnetic field and electric field are absolutely intertwined. So one of the perspectives I heard recently with a toroidal breakthrough this gentleman had made, which I find profound, because he's talking about influencing crop growth by 400% over miles of radius from this simple device. The magnetic field has an amazing ability to store potential energy, and the electric field has an amazing ability to tap that energy and direct it, as long as you do it intelligently.
Yeah, that
kind of reminds me
really
a little bit of John DePew. Go ahead.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's going to be great when we can get all guys together in the same room for a couple of hours. One day it's going to be kind of interesting to see what can happen. If we can indeed get the ego out of the way, it'd be amazing what could happen.
Well, hopefully it won't be like the monkeys with the loaded gun in the cage analogy.
Well, I think, Don, one of your original things was, could we find some scientists who didn't have the ego that would actually be able to create profound things? And I think the three of you are three people that I know that could do that.
It's a good sign that it probably helps a lot for a person to be spiritually oriented to be able to get to this level. And I guess the fact that there are not that many spiritually oriented scientists, there are a lot of scientists that do give regard to spirits, but there's not very many spiritually oriented scientists that start out there and work backwards into the science rather than trying to find spirituality in science.
Well, you know, can I read a
comment? Isn't it interesting that even some of the most traditionally hallowed scientists like Einstein essentially still put spiritualism first by saying, if it wasn't for that side, what would be the point? I mean, Einstein said this.
Yep.
So, you know, this whole point of trying to separate analysis of our reality without taking into consideration the consciousness that's trying to perceive it is another, for me, profoundly funny idiocy.
Don, you got to make comment on that one because that's right up your alley.
Am I still
Don?
On? Can you hear me?
Yeah,
you're
still
me?
On. I mean, that's just, but I mean,
yeah.
The three
I,
of you are very
yeah.
much that way. But
well, like I said, it obviously helps a lot to be spiritually oriented, but it's like I was saying, that's where I start. I start with the spirit and work my way back to the science, and I try to find spirituality in science than trying to start off with the science and prove the spirituality, because I don't think it's possible that way. But the truth never suffers from an honest observation. So I start off with the spirit, and I just observe every part of it until I just observe it as far as I can get it. And usually the science shows up in there.
It's a bit like the relationship between magnetics and electricity, isn't it? I mean, you could call the spiritualism the magnetics and the science the electricity. The two are interrelated.
That's what we've been saying. If you boil all that down to the most primary level, you find these real and imaginary components that are 90 degrees out of phase with each other. So they're at right angles to each other. And the combination of those things is what's creating every geometry, every shape, every reality, everything that we know, every complex wave function is built from combinations of these real and imaginary components. And that's the only problem in the world. Is the only issues that are going on in the world right now is this unresolution between real and imaginary, between actual and potential. And
I'm having a thought.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Here's the question. The thing is when Mike started out, he's talking about putting scientists together, but the biggest problem was ego. And it appears to me, from the conversations from the beginning into the end of this, is that we're all on this exploratory adventure to actually understand the universe as it is and who we are in our referencing in it. But like you say, Don, we're just space within space looking to resolve our differences between the separation. And if we as peoples or scientists or the consciousness that needs to evolve to have these gifts of free energy or whatever you want to call it to understand it, then the consciousness must come first. Because even, Mike, with all the people that you're doing it with, still the level of separation will never bring it to its fruition. Would that be true? Because it's still in conflict and still in separation.
I think what you're describing is how the planet operates. This is a synergistic system, you know, and to deny synergy is to deny reality. Or to deny irreality or imaginary.
It almost seems like you need a checklist, Mike.
It's all intrinsic.
It is, but it's also all self-referencing. So I mean, it's
almost
like you need a checklist of your scientists.
I would also
say that
an analogy is you can look at the complexity of an issue, just like you can go through a lifetime looking at all the symptoms of a disease, or you can simply take a little blue pill that you know cures it. So, or it's like deciding to pilot a boat from England to New York and realizing that the concept is simple, but the process, unless you know exactly what you're doing, could get incredibly complex, especially if you don't know where the sun should be, and if you don't you don't have any way to make sure that you stay on track, right? So this is why I like to see the blend of understanding the complex synergy from the perspective of some simple guidelines, which keep you on a course direction that's survivable.
Don has a comment on that. Go for it, Don.
That's exactly why we created the portal, is to give somebody the right tool. You only really need three things to affect transformation. You need active pursuit on the person that's changing part. You need the right tools, which are like a map and the directions and the instructions on how to get there. And you need dedicated support. You can't really do it by yourself. You need somebody to have a sounding board to hear yourself talk, because you'll say something to someone else that you won't say to yourself. And so it requires those things. And the portal, we feel like, is sort of like a set of tools that basically provide all of the resources for transformation, of a way of tracking yourself through that journey.
Well, Don, you've given me the incredible fortune to play with that, and all I can say is I look at the portal as a friend.
Yeah, it really gives you the ability to become your own dedicated support partner, to where it's like there's another person there present. And it sort of provides that whole need for a facilitator and that sort of thing by allowing you to do that for yourself.
Right. So you whisper sweet nothings and it says, you're an idiot. No, I'm just kidding. I'm finding it very useful.
People tend to want to use it as a manifestation machine to manifest their intentions, and it will work like that. However, a more important use of it is to really get a handle on why you're wanting all those things, and then define who you would be if you had all of them. Because that's really the more important question is that what is a person's manner of being and manner of doing, and why are they after all these things? Why do they want to make these changes? Why do they want to own that? Why do they want to achieve that? What's it going to do for who they are? And if you can start defining who you are as an optimal person, as if you had all those things, if you had your health and your finances and your business and your relations and all of those things going good, people will tell me that that's the goal in their life, and I have to remind them that that's just the starting point. When you have all those things lined up, that's when you get to start living. That's not the goal. And so if you can define who you are at that level, who you would be if you had all those things, that's really the ultimate use of the technology.
Which is really the level of consciousness what we need to get to, is what we are here as creators creating. And for what purpose?
Yes.
Exactly.
Joseph, you want to say anything?
And I think one of the purposes should be because it's fun.
It should be fun.
Well, yeah, that's when you actually come and do a session, I mean, we can actually even get more of that in. There's music therapy that's included in that, and an eyes closed, lucid dreaming experience, and swimming with dolphins, and 3D virtual reality, and other things that make it so enticing that it really opens you up to going into that deep space to where you have an aha or an epiphany or a sudden realization about something that just changes your life forever.
Oh, I love it so
far. You know
far.
What? Yeah, I'm going to put it this way. Joseph, where are you?
I'm here.
I know. Okay, here's everything that Don's talking about, and I've been blessed to know Joseph. And Joseph, when he had the Sonic Temple, created something where we went into this place where he had the healing beds, and he put in fresh oxygen. We did breath work, and even our own human technology supported with good sound, great air, some of the stuff we can even do on our own. But I still think I love the idea of the malls of education where we can put all this stuff. We can do some breakthroughs. So do you want to say something about how that worked in the Sonic Temple of the Consciousness? Because consciousness relates to all of this. Even when we're talking about how we redo energy, to me, it still has to do with how it is reflective of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, the environment, even the atmosphere itself, like in the structure, like at the Sonic Temple, one of the things that I spent an incredible amount of time was actually designing an air-to-air process where basically I was pumping in upwards of 60 liters of pure oxygen. We're talking like 95% pure, 5% noble gases, which was being pumped into the facility, and then it was going through a cold plasma ozone ionization system to basically convert about 1% of that oxygen to a hyper-ionized state, not the radical type of O1 ozone that's destructive to the lungs, but polymolecular ozone, which is O2 chained up in O4, O8, O16, O32, and then that was bubbled through 350 gallons of ultra-purified atmospheric condensed water that was then remineralized using the rose salt from all over the planet, like from five different sources, the ancient old rose salt. And then also that water was then mineralized using a product concentrates where I was dumping like upwards of $1,000 every 6 months of minerals into this pool, and then that oxygen was bubbled through that living water, and then that air was then circulated through the entire structure so that you were in. I mean, when people walked into the Sonic, the first thing they went was, wow, it smells like we're in a forest. It smells like there was a rainstorm, a thunderstorm, and, you know, people that did breath work, that we did integrated breath work there, people would go through incredible, profound shifts in a very rapid, short time because the air was consciousness. It was a living air. It was full of the right energies, the right construct energies, and also in a practical sense, intentional magic. Because we would hold ceremony where we would go down to where the big tank of water was, and people who were very intuned or gifted healers would do prayers for that water and then place their hands into that water. And many times there was actual electric sparks that would take place, like you could see the emissions. And then in the jets where the water was being pumped back into the pool, where the oxygen was being dispensed, when you turned off all the lights, you could actually see a violet glow at the nozzles where the oxygen was being injected into the water and vorticulated at the same time. So that water was very much alive. And then that was the essence of the vapor that was going into the air system of the Sonic Temple. So, and that was a very long, thought-out, divinely inspired process, because that was basically about 20 years worth of research that I did. And so that Sonic wasn't just a building with some fancy sound technology. It was an environment. It was a hyperspace environment where when you walked in, you were enveloped in that atmosphere that you were inhaling, that your skin was touching. And then when you intentionally sit down to do a prayer, a meditation, a breath session, whatever process that you were involved with, you were intimately connected to the environment through your respiration.
I see Dawn and you with that sensorium mixing that stuff, and
the similarities between his work and my work are just amazing. I'm just sitting here listening to him talking, and he's just like basically defying the past 15 years of my life as well. It's amazing that we, you know, how the universe gives you the little parts of this, but always puts you, you know, it arranges, the personality arranges you to run into the person who's got the next piece that makes the bigger thing. And I can see Joseph's process hooked up with my process, whereby instead of putting the attention on the water exogenously by people standing around and trying to put the information on the water, we can ask the water to go through a process itself to where it has to become the agent of its own own transformation. And in that manner, the the information stays on the water. It doesn't change when the next person comes along and thinks something different. It amplifies that process and secures it in there in such a way that it never really goes away. So I can see the two processes that put together that would be both. It would be a situation where people would be drinking this and breathing it, because we've already proven on our process will work
Don,
on anything that's liquid or gaseous. So we could definitely
make that. We just need to ask for funding. We need big funding to make this happen. Can you imagine? Oh, my goodness gracious. And you and I, Don, need to find our way up to Vancouver to meet Joseph, because Lauren's up there anyway.
Yeah.
That could be where our first big event is, where we can show off the technology of the portal and introduce my new book, and Joseph's got the foreword on it. I nothing would elate me more. Oh, anyway, that just sends me to the moon, that idea. So anyway, you guys, go ahead.
So I think that's the best idea that combines everything that you and I have always talked about and all your guests have always talked about, is to have one of these sensorium entertainment places that combines a themed restaurant with a virtual reality theme park that's all based on nonviolent, non-competitive, non-combative forms of virtual reality and consciousness experiences, and a little way for them to sit down and converse about that afterwards. And but just become a whole new way for people to socialize, and so they don't go to bars anymore or movies or coffee shop to hang out or their friend's house. They go to this place to where they can have a mind-blowing experience and then sit down and be able to talk to people about it.
Yep. I get it. You guys, we have about 3 minutes before the show ends. And Mike, is there anything you want to conclude on this?
Yeah, my primary focus is on the energy technologies and gathering what we need. But the place that what I consider important and the place I want to play is exactly what Don, you and Joseph are talking about. That is really the point of all this, is to take us to another level. I sort of see a lot of the work I'm doing with these energy technologies as being just foundation.
And it sounds like with Don and Joseph, and I know what your heart's at, it's to make a better world. And maybe if we get everybody more conscious than the energy idea of where we play with our time, Don, then we can have the technologies, because we've moved into a whole new reality.
Yeah, I found that when I had the places that we built, when I had those places, you could tell that it increased a person's consciousness just to be in the space. So that's the you're not going to get them online. You're not going to get them when they're being distracted by something else going on. You're only going to get them when you have them in your space. And
right. You
can control all of those factors, and you can suddenly slip them into that little moment where they have that aha, and they go, oh, my God, I suddenly get it. Where do I sign on?
Yep. Yep,
it's all about the fun
Joseph.
And the play again, isn't it?
Well, it is about the raising of consciousness into the place where we can live in our own heaven on earth in bliss. That sounds like fun to me.
And it should be enjoyable.
Isn't it funny how playing and being a kid is what it's all about?
It is.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree.
It's the child in you that taps in.
Yeah. It's all about happiness.
It is at the end of the day, and I think something that I read where we talk about the planet has become a ghetto in a sense in its mind, and how do we get back to having heaven on earth? And it is through our transition of consciousness and getting to and through our egos, and looking at
and
them and appreciating them. Go ahead, Mike.
Collaborative happiness is really the key. Selfish happiness is an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, anyway, I'm going to say thank you to the Awakening Zone so much for allowing Science to Sage to exist, for letting the magazine come alive. All of these gentlemen are in the issue of Imagine and a few others, sustainability and subtle energies, all these different issues where you can explore their ideas broader and bigger. And so with that, I'd like to say thank you to the Awakening Zone for hosting us. And gentlemen, thank you so much for indulging me today and being on the show and sharing your profound wisdom. I am very grateful, that you're all friends. So thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to the Awakening Zone Radio Network, offering insights and inspiration for our evolving consciousness.